Joe was, came back in 84, we bought a sailboat in the freezer. So we missed a lot of that, you know, that particular period. We missed a lot of the, the pipeline boom, the oil boom, the early days of the oil boom.
We first came up here in 1967 then, so were you stationed out there at the base?
Yeah, I went out there. I was, for a while I was the administrative officer, and then I became the security officer. I stayed out there for 3 years before I retired.
No stories, no fun stories of security out there? Real quiet?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot happening on the base. There was a lot of stuff happening around the base. What happened was after the tidal wave, there were a number of people around here that were homeless. And so the Navy used to own all of Bell's flats out there. And they had Quonset Hudson warehouses and just all kinds of stuff out there. Well, there were a lot of people who moved in, and maybe let them move in after the tidal wave. So that was a big flap when I first got here, because these people would move out. They liked it. The rent was pretty expensive. And so they were living back there, and there was some kind of wild stuff. I was sitting in the security office one afternoon, must have been about probably 69, and one of the gate guards came rushing to the office. He said that the guy just arrived out there, and he looked terrible. He had bandaged around his head and blood all over him and everything. And he said he just shot a man out at Bell's Flats. Well, it was Navy property at the time. It was just sort of iffy, I guess. But anyway, we responded to it and went out there. In one of the Quonsets, the guy was lying there dead, shot by a phony con over a woman, as you might guess. So we had a number of things that happened like that. Things were a lot rougher around here back in those days. The hippies were just starting to show up here from down below, and they were bringing in drugs and that sort of thing, and that didn't go over at all with the with people who lived in the Kodiak. And one of the first ones that came in was shot down out there in Bell Flats, Josh Manwood. I think he was shot with a .44.
One of the hippies?
Well, he was a drug dealer. He was a hippie drug dealer, whatever. He was somebody that brought drugs into town and they didn't want people like that. So some concerned citizen knocked him off. And never did find out his place. It is known who the person was. Nobody, particularly the police, kind of good riddance to bad weather.
Was there the alcohol problem? Because I know when I was up here, mid-70s and stuff, and we're talking, you were going 76, 84, I was up here 75, 77, there was an awful alcohol problem. So did you have those problems back then, too?
Oh, sure. Yeah, booze was a big problem in Kodiak. There was a lot of money back then, a lot of money from Kingsbury and Halliburton. And there were characters that come in on these fishing boats and they threw money around like water. The entire complexion of Kodiak was different. And that the kind of a wild lifestyle was expected. There was one guy that used to come into town whenever the boat came in, and he'd go into the. I think he used to hang out with Tony's or South. And he'd have a whole pocket full of money, and he got paid off the end of the trip, a number of thousands. And he'd get some kid, put the money all but $1,000, put it in an envelope, tell the kid to take home his wife. And then he'd just sit there and he'd drink and buy drinks for the house or whatever until that $1,000 was gone. And then he'd go home. We did it every day. They had a tradition up here that in those days they called six packing, and you could go into some of these bars and sit down and order a drink. Next thing you know, there's six of the same thing sitting in front of you. Some guy across the bar is six packing, and then you could do it back to him. It could get pretty bad, you're sitting there in the whole bar in front of you. So,
Indeed.
As a matter of fact, there was one time there was down at the village bar, a guy called up from, I think he was down in Mexico. I think he was on vacation down in Mexico. Someplace. Anyway, he called up the bar and said, "Hey, you got a bunch of people in there?" "Yeah." "Well, six pack the house." He said, "I'll pay you when I get back." yeah, these guys, the bars used to be like anchors for the Christian would come into town. And he'd have this whole roll of money and he'd give it to the bartender, and the bartender put it in an envelope and he'd write down the amount, and they put it in the safe for whatever they had behind the bar. And when this guy needed some more money, he'd come in and get it, on the bar, and they'd just write down how much he took out. And some of them would say, "No, I don't want you, I don't care how drunk I get, I don't want you to give me more than, $500. He'd come back, and of course, almost invariably, they drink up to 500 and then they want more, and they're going to hassle with the bartender about whether they're going to get back to them.
Did almost all the bars do that, or was just certain numbers of them?
Yeah, it was pretty common practice.
Now, I've heard stories of the ship, the Beachcomber.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know how that boat got here, or? How long was it here or anything?
It was here when I got here, but if I remember right, Legs LeBrew bought it down in Seattle, and it was going to be scrapped. And he bought it for, don't hold me to this, but it seems to me that it was something like $25,000. It was pretty cheap. And he had it hauled up here, and they dug a trench in from the cove down there, and they ran it in, and then they distilled it around it, and left it high and dry, and put it into a hotel and nightclub.
That's the the old Salvation Army parking lot, right?
Well, yeah, on the north edge of the parking lot is where it was. And it was pretty wide. But we used to enjoy going there. They used to make a thing they called a steak sandwich. It had no, you know, it didn't look like a steak sandwich at all. And it was really reasonable. And so if you're out partying, you know, in the evening or whatever, along about 2 o'clock in the morning, you can always put a piece on it. Get the steak sandwich and then it's a piece of filet about that thick, you know, and french fries and all of that. So it was a neat place, but it did get pretty rough. I remember one time we had a trooper here, I can't remember his name. Well, he was big, he was in the house. Great big guy, probably about 6 foot. He must have been 6 foot four or five, and he had to easily weigh 275, I guess, just to see. And there was some kind of a riot going on in the Beachcombers one night, and he went in, and about 5 minutes later, they backed him out of there. I mean, I don't know if they had any reinforcements. Back then, there was only one trooper in town. Well, when we got here, there was only one trooper in town. And his name was Bob Locke. And Bob was kind of like law west of the Pecos, you know. Bob was the law from here out to the entire Ocean chain. And he used to make a patrol out there. He went out with the Coast Guard twice a year, I think. And they'd hit all the little villages along the chain and so forth. And Bob was kind of like judge and jury and magistrate and the whole thing, you know. If somebody had committed a crime in the village, when the ship pulled in, they'd know the ship was coming, you know, and they'd have the offenders down there on the dock, and seen them jailed or anything, but where's the guy gonna go, you know? And they'd have them there on the dock, and they'd say, all right, this is what he did, and it was real bad, you know, like every now and then he'd be a murderer or something. Bob would take him back to the But a lot of times he'd just hold court on him right there, you know. And whether that was legal or not, I don't really know, but it worked. You know. Yeah, he was quite a guy.
You were the security officer, so where would his jurisdiction end? I've heard that the gate used to be up at Dead Man's Point, and I've heard different places. What was the physical location of, like, the base security?
When I got here, the gate was right where it is now. But the Navy property went to Dead Man's Church. And we shared jurisdiction with the state. There was always a kind of a little friendly argument about who had the primary jurisdiction on the road. But it never became important enough so it had to be brought up in court or anything. It was just an agreement that the base law enforcement people and the city law enforcement people got along really well.
They have like Cinderella Liberty or anything like that, or was it?
No, not when I got here. They had in the past, as I understand it, during and for a few years after the war. And again, that was when the gate was out there in the church. And I think they did make the guys come back and bed man. Have you ever gone on the base, and you go down? down the main road from the gate. And you look off to your left by the chapel and you see a kind of square depression in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it used to be called Roll's Hole. The skipper there, Captain Roll. And he came up there and he said, well, again, wintertime, skating is good recreational thing in the winter, so we're going to build a skate rink. And I don't guess he'd ever seen a skate rink. He didn't know how to go. So he got a bunch of people together and he said, I want you to scrape out a hole down there and then fill in some cold water and make a skate rink. So they did. They scraped it out, and of course it never did work. Although I did see, last year I think it was, I noticed they had gotten some ice on that. I don't know how they managed to do it. But yeah, it rolled full.
Well, the temperatures and weather changes frequently. Do you remember the winters being any worse, any better, the same?
The worst winter that I remember having was the winter of 70 and 71. And that was the year that I retired from the Navy, and there was a fellow here at the Forest Service. I'm terrible in names, Gordy Edgar. And he was the Forest Service rep here. And at that time, the Forest Service owned all the fogging. That was before the Navy Marine Corps. And so they were laying out a cut that they were going to do our terminus today. And anyway, Gordy and I were friends, and I had gotten out of the Navy that fall, and I didn't have much to do. I wasn't working. And he said, why don't we go on up to Danger Bay and go trapping? So we're going to trap otters. So sounded like a good idea. So we packed a bunch of gear and a goose, and we went up there, I think it was right after New Year's, and landed there. There's a little cabin, a little Forest Service cabin there that the Forest Service guys had used when they were laying up the sail. So we used that. And we were pretty well equipped. We had a rubber boat, the kicker, and all that sort of thing. And the idea was we were going to use that boat to go around the bay and not go too far from the shore and we'll set the traps up in there, right? Yeah, well, about 2 days after we got there, the temperature went down to 0 or 5 or 10 below or something like that. And the bay froze. So we were up there for 3 weeks. We spent 3 weeks on snowshoes, camping all over that area, setting traps. And the whole 3 weeks netted us one beaver and three otters. And, but that was a really cold winter. I remember snowshoeing right through a herd of elk. And they just stood there and looked at you. They'd be as close as they made to you. This was after probably a couple of weeks, that cold. And then they just stood there and looked at you. They didn't want to make you move. And see, at that time, the elk herd on the Fog Neck, the figure was somewhere around 2,500, 2,000 animals. And after, I think it was after that winter, they were down, 500 or 600, something like that. They had a big winter field. And eventually, I think it went down to maybe about 250 animals. It's built above that now. But with all the lumbering over there, it'll never get back to 2,500, 2,000. But that was too bad. It used to be the Marines every year had a field exercise. They went over to the recreation camp on the Fog Neck Lake. And it was supposed to be field exercise, but really they took a lot of beer along and took the rifles along and so forth, and they went out there to hunt elk. And the year that I got there, they had ambushed a whole herd of elk coming down off the mountain by Molina. And you could see when these elk started moving, so many of them, that they'd make a big wide swath, big pathway down, through the grass. And you could see it coming down this mountain. And got down into the valley and so forth, and then you started seeing the kills with these guys in the herd. I don't know how many animals they took. But, and then of course they had to pack them out. Well, they learned something about packing meat those days too, you know, because you go on the trail and you'd see pieces of animal, you know, leg bones and stuff like this that they suddenly figured that they couldn't carry that anymore. Right? Yeah, that used to be a big deal for me.
Did you ever go on any of those trips, any good hunting trips like that?
No, not really. I spent a lot of time in the fog. I had a collateral duty. As the admin officer, the recreation department was in my recreation division was in my department, and I got pretty friendly with the recreation director. He said, "Hey, really had it." But anyway, and his big project when I got here was to get the recreation camp going. There's quite a history to that camp. I don't know if you have you ever been over to Fog Neck Lake?
Just one over.
Well, about about a quarter of the way up the lake on the north side, the north shore, there's some buildings. It used to be a hatchery that was built by the Alaska Packers back in the 20s and 30s. And largely as a public relations gimmick, because Alaska Packers were held responsible for wiping out the Santa Claus and they about wiped out Carlton, has never fully recovered. It's a whole lot better now than it was. But they built this hatchery over there on Fognack, and they ran it for a few years, and then the war came along, and the Navy took it over, and they used it as an auxiliary seaplane base. And so after the war, the Navy kind of let it go. They ran it as a rec camp for a while, and then they kind of let it go. And there was a guy that picked up a use permit on it. He ran it for a while. He was then accused by the Navy of dynamiting the stream and stuff like that. So he lost his permit to it. The Navy took it back. So when I got here, they were trying to build it back up again. We had a tug here on the base, and the tug during the season would make a run over the Fognack, and we'd take a bunch of people over the trip. So we had a manager's cabin, a permanent staff over there, and three or four people. And then we had a bunkhouse, and there were a couple of houses that the families would stay in, you know, and they had a barn, you know, all that sort of thing. And it was really nice. And so I spent my time over there as I could. I had to go over there and supervise. Yeah. So we learned that, of course, until Well, pretty much still a Navy guy, and then it converted. That's the land time, it converted. To the Navy. Kind of too bad it's happened at camp over there now, it's very too trash. People go over there hunting, you know, and they stay in it. Instead of taking care of it, the trash is always, you torn a couple of the buildings almost completely torn down. They used it to do the wood and the firewood. There's a stack of cans outside, so I don't know which one is about 4 feet high. It's a shame. But it's a beautiful place. It's one of my favorite places in the world.
You were talking about some of the morale facilities. They've had the camp over there. Do you remember the ski show?
Yeah, I remember the ski show. That was the other thing that they were trying to get going. And we spent a lot of time and effort on the ski show. And again, they were gearing up for it when I got here. They were getting that geared up, and they had a rope show, and they didn't have it. It was elaborate setup that they have up there now, but they had a rope show and a few other odds and ends, and a bunch of equipment that we rented out. And I think in the 3 years that I was involved with it, maybe half a dozen weekends, you had snow on the slope. Because you know how the weather is here. It'll snow, and you'll get everything ready to go skiing and so forth. You might get one day, and you might not. And the rain comes along once in a while.
Well, the road to get up there was always a thrill too. If you get a lot of snow and you never pass, you just about packed in.
Boy, I tell you what, that whole area out there by the base was something. We raised two boys here. And the one son, Rob, I was talking to him last night, and he was sitting around the table out there, talking about some of the things he did as a kid. He's 36 years old now, so the back of those days. And he talked about the area in around Boy Scout Lake and some of the things that they discovered in the buildings and stuff that had been moved out of and were untouched. He was talking about one that they found. He said it was two stories. It was completely dry inside. There was a window that looked out over the bay. And there were two stories to it, and it still had, you know, a bunch of stuff in there that left there, from back in the 40s and the 80s and something like that. And they were going to use this as some kind of a clubhouse or whatever they were going to do. And they found it, and they could never find it again. Yeah, they went back looking for it, and they couldn't find it again, because it's real dense in there. And there are all kinds of roads, trails, and stuff, they're all over. But you can get a few of those things too. So,
are there any charts or maps or any of the roads that you remember?
Used to have some, and I may still have it, because when I was leaving there, I guess it was when I was leaving the Badman Hospital to go to security. They were getting ready to throw away a whole bunch of old records. And I think that I may have kept some of those old maps. You know. That area there, and then the one with the Burma Road, the other up above Preston Lake. The guy that we bought this house from, a fellow named John Tryon, a real Alaskan character. And John made his living as a wrangler, and he was a carpenter, and he was a fisherman, and he did a lot of different things. Well, not too long before we bought the house, he had been in an accident, and he lost one leg, and pretty much lost use of the other one. But up until that time, he had been scavenging copper and lead from that area up above Buston Lake. And that whole area, and it's still there. There is cable all over that place. It used to be a power cable and communication cable that ran to all of these different facilities. It was set up up there. See, they had 100,000 feet cable. Yeah. Old John would go up there and without any real serious concern about who this stuff belonged to, you know. And he'd get a hold of some of this cable and I think he had a cat or something, I don't know. But anyway, and he'd just rip it out backwards, you know. Rip out as much as he could and cut up the chunks and throw it back in the pickup truck. And then you bring it down here. And as you go out, you look at that the hill, and the upper lot is back here. It's kind of a steep hill. John had some corrugated roofing, and he'd put that up there and build a fire underneath the roofing. And he put the this lead covered stuff on top of it. And then he made up some molds out of bread tins. And he had those on the lower end of the lower edge of his corrugated roofing so that when the lead melted, it ran off and it went into the bread tin. And he figured that the lead paid all of his expenses for recovering this stuff, whatever expenses he had, and the copper that he recovered was free. So John, that was part of the part of his claim of lost income. The amount of copper that was left in the ground. he won a settlement, $1.5 million, which at that time was the biggest personal injury settlement that ever been won, I fear.
Now, who did he sue?
He sued an insurance company. Usually, you sue another individual, another entity of some sort, and an insurance company covers it. But in this case, he had been hit by an insurance company employee who was coming home from an insurance company party, and he was drunk. Well, so was John. John was out there in the middle of the road with the lights on, his car had stalled out. It was over by, it was over around Homer someplace. Anyway, he was out there in the middle of the road, and the car was, you know, crosswise in the road, and he was under the hood fumbling around with something, and this other guy came along and smacked him. And, you know,
with all the buildings and stuff that were out there in the base and the Burma Road, do you recognize any of the things, or is it just all grown over? When you look just a few years, you know, since I've been up here, just the big changes.
Just a few years ago, I guess, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, the government had cleanup teams. They cleaned up an awful lot of stuff. And so a lot of that stuff was torn down and dug up and all the way. And so, and I haven't even been back in there. I don't know what that was. They couldn't torn it all down.
There's a lot of foundations and stuff in there.
Gone
through all of the walks and stuff, and small buildings, foundations and stuff, and all of the quandaries. What did they keep in all of those things back there? Do you remember?
When I was here, it was vacant. They didn't keep anything. But we kept some ammunition. Up above Buston Lake, and But most of the stuff is,
You'd mentioned before when I talked to you that you were an AB.
Yeah.
I was part of an AB. Did you fly up here at all?
No. I joined the Navy in 1950, and I went to med school. And, I made second class out on the East Coast. And then I got out of the Navy for several months, came back in, and went over to VF-114. Fighter squad in Miramar, California, made crews with them, and came back and I figured out that there wasn't much future in the next race. In the far ahead, you could see, you could ace these bands, and I was a promoter. But they needed people in electronics. Anyway, I got into a kind of accelerated electronics program when I went back to Memphis. I went to Memphis for about a year, both parts of A school and parts of B school. And then another 6 months guided missile school down in Jacksonville. And I came out to Seal Beach, and by this time I was first class. But I had figured when I came back into the Navy that the only thing to do was to get information. You know, those were the times I could. And so I got into this, we call it the integration program, the Seaman Admiral program, in 1958. And I went into the circus team. And pretty much stayed in the gunnery for the rest of my shipboard tours were all the gunnery weapons.
I noticed on one of the plaques that you were an advisor.
Yeah.
Vietnam advisor. When did you?
I went out to Vietnam in '66. And I went out there, I was with what they called the Sea Force. And I used to ride the Vietnamese ship. We'd go out on patrol for 30, 45 days, different parts of the country.
Who was the Vietnamese?
The Vietnamese, yeah. I was the only American on board. And I was on a patrol craft, except for one cruise they did up in the Delta on well, it's an LSSL, but it's kind of a gunboat. But otherwise, I was on a PC, and got to see a lot of the country, all the way from the DMZ to the Fuquay Islands and stuff. But I came in the Delta. It was an interesting tour.
How long were you now?
A year.
66 and 67.
66 and 67. Yeah, I came back here in September of 67. And the deal was that the Navy said that if you did an in-country tour in Vietnam, the policy was that they would send you anybody who wanted to go for the tour, if they could at all do it. So I remember writing my wife. I told him, I said, where do you want to go? He said, I'll send me anywhere I want. And so she got the letter. Well, I couldn't wait for the reply. And so I put in for Alaska because I went through some hard decisions to sort of kick back after that, all that. After I had done that, I got her a letter and she wanted to go to Greece or Spain or Hawaii or.
I guess wrong.
But that's something she enjoyed. She's been really great. We left here in 76 and bought a 36-foot cutter down in in Marina Del Rey. We sailed it from there to St. Petersburg, Florida. It took about 4.5 years to do. And so, about a year in Mexico, and the rest of the time, Central America.
Through the canal or around
yeah,
the
corner? Yeah, no, I'm not, I don't like self-punishment. That's taking around the moon. We owned, Dr. Bob Johnson had a sailboat here. And then it was about a 1938 wooden catch. And it was the only one in town. He and his dad had bought it up some years before. And I went out with him a couple of times and ended up buying it. So we had the only sailboat in town. Lindbergh was the only one, I guess, that had ever been here. Or at least, just electric.
It was all rigged so that two people could sail it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it doesn't take any special rigging for two people. It takes a little special rigging for one person to sail it, but the two people, nothing special.
You two got people to drive most of the time.
Well, we took turns.
Oh, okay.
We're going down the coast when we took off from San Diego.
Yeah. So most of the time, though, Norma wasn't your main, huh? You had to say, aye, Captain.
No. I believe in the old Navy system. You got it. You only had one skipper, and that was me.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But, boy, I tell you, she was good health. She was great. We got into a gale our first run. We were going down the Mexican coast, and we got into a gale. Seas built up real steep, and we were surfing down those waves. And I was down below sleeping. Came back up the next morning. We had four people on the boat, Rob, and my other son, and uncle, and made the trip down to Baja. And I said, God, how fast were you going last night? So I could hear the water rushing. She said, the speedometer said 14 knots.
Oh my God!
At 14 knots, the sailboat surfing down a wave from it. If the helmsman makes a mistake, that the keel is going to tip the boat. So we were, it was more than it though. It was all right. That was good. We're making good time.
It was going in the direction you wanted, at least.
Yeah. Well, we had 5 days to get it. Took us seven or 8 days, I think, to get to Cabo San Lucas, but 5 days and we did.
So you just pull into the port down there then, or find a bay?
Well, there was an anchorage there. And we pulled in the anchor, doing other cruising boats and so forth. And we spent about 9 months in the Sea of Cortez, I guess. We cruised up to about halfway up the Sea of Cortez, a place called Santa Rosalia. And then we went across to Guaymas.
What would you do for 9 months?
What do you do for 9 months? What do we do for 4.5 years?
You just out in the ocean, I mean, where are you doing? Skin diving, scuba diving?
Yeah, we did a lot of things. You see, there's a cruising community. There's, at any given time, there's maybe 100, 150 people. Maybe not so many now. I don't know. But with sailboats that are making essentially the same cruise. And on this coast, there's two basic cruises you can make. And one of them is down the Pacific coast of Panama, through the canal, back up to the East Coast somewhere. The other one is to the Marquesas and Trinidad to the east and westward. Usually, those cruises end up in New Zealand or Australia. So, but anyway, and there are only so many anchors. And so you keep running into the same people all the time. So there's a kind of a little community that builds up. And it's fluid because people drop into it and out of it. You know, some people will go faster than others. Usually there'll be a couple of three boats that kind of loosely join up with one another and they see each other quite a bit. That's a good thing. So we did a lot of that. You do a lot of beach combing, you do fishing, snorkeling, diving. A lot of that is done for food. We depended for most of our animal protein a lot of the time on what we could get out of the city. Because there'd be times where we'd go 45, 50, maybe 60 days, and we would be in areas so remote that we had to depend on what we had aboard. Particularly parts of one stretch that I can think of is between Costa Rica and Panama. And I think it took us probably 6 weeks or so to make that. We'd make an overnight or a 2 or 3 day passage, something like that. At one point, I think one leg.